Thank you, Tom. It's marvelous to be in Orlando. It's marvelous to have people to ask you to come visit with them. The last time anybody in this part of Florida asked me to do something for them was in 1958, and I was practicing medicine over in Melbourne, and they asked me to leave. It's appropriate for me to be here. There are more old drunks than there are old doctors. And I'm doubly blessed because my name is Dr. Gene Morton and I'm an alcoholic. I am. That's what happened. Yeah, yeah. I'm also a male chauvinist pig. And so far this convention has done nothing for my pigism. The strength, hope, and love that these ladies have talked last night and today have shown us is overpowering. And if I can just remind you of something they said, I'll have done a good job. I would like to complain to the people that put this schedule together. This is the first time that a high-bottom drunk has had to follow a low-bottom Al-Anon in my memory, and I don't know. Oh, yeah. You know, I got acquainted with AA. We didn't have addicts. I was an alcoholic and a depraved dope fiend. That's what I was. That was the hardest lesson I ever learned. It took me 30 years to come to understand that I was an alcoholic. I'll fix my move to the other side here. So difficult to understand. And you know, I really believe that the people that know what alcoholism is are restricted to groups like ourselves who have either experienced the disease or experienced a loved one with the disease and then suffered the agony of recovery in this particular and most wonderful of all ways through this 12-step program. Other people care and other people are compassionate, but there's some part of our problem they don't quite understand. I don't know of any other disease, and this is a disease that's like that. I did practice medicine in Melbourne from about 1956 to about 1959, then I stuck around a couple of more years doing something. And I did general practice. That's what we used to call family practice. I was a GP. And we did everything. And in Melbourne, there were 18 GPs and 13 specialists in those days. And we delivered babies. My gosh, we delivered babies. There was no anesthesiologist in Melbourne, so we believed in natural childbirth. And you know, it just seems that at least in those years, that the distaff had an unbreakable covenant with one another, that they always presented labor as a painful experience. And I have a hard time believing that. I can well recall the sacrifice of the male part as this condition is conceived, and I don't quite understand how something that starts off with such pleasure and wonder can end up painfully, but I guess we'll never know, will we? Because one night, I know I was delivering a young 21-year-old girl of her first child, and all she was nervous, and she was having trouble, and she didn't have anything to stop her pain. And I hadn't had a drink for 6 or 8 hours, and I was nervous. And her husband had been overseas for 11 months, and he was nervous. And he was pacing the hall saying, "I believe her, I believe her, I believe her." But it was a mess. And I can remember this girl taking a deep breath, and I thought, "Oh my God, it's going to happen." And then panting, sound like a choo-choo train. And yeah, and there it came. And it was slippery. But I caught it before it hit the floor almost. And we kind of cleaned it up, you know, and she smiled and thought it was pretty. And I went back to the doctor's lounge where there was another physician. And I mixed me a little brute and coke and sat down, and he and I were discussing this fiasco, the pain of childbirth. And we talked and we talked, and there was a maid cleaning up. Now, she had 10 kids. And she listened patiently for a while, and then she finally looked at me and she said, "Well, doctor, it do hurt." And I said, "Well, what do it feel like?" And she said, "Well, take your lip between your thumb and your forefingers." And I did. She said, "Now pull it forward." And I did. She said, "Now slip it over your head." Now, it might hurt to have a baby, you see, and I'll accept that, but I still don't know quite how it feels. And that's the way alcoholism is, and that's certainly the way mine was. It was as if I'd had an unwanted pregnancy that lasted and lasted and lasted and grew and grew and grew until I was completely absorbed by it. And I tried so hard to hide it. And I even tried to hide it after it was evident to all that knew me. And then one day I went into labor. And I was delivered of alcoholism. And I experienced the miracle of new birth. And this happened in my life, you see. People talk about being spiritual bankrupt. And that's horrible. But I was spiritually dead. And that's a fact. I was not part of anything. There was no spirit about me. None. I was living alone in a mission house on North Broadway Street in Oklahoma City, and I didn't care. And I was apart from it. And I was living in it. And I had no relationship to food, to air, to life, to sleep, to people. And my spirit was dead. Remember one time I was driving out in the country and stopped to get some water from a farmer. And there was an old hound dog laying under the porch, wagging his tail and making dog sounds. And I got his little cup and put some water in it, took it over to give it to him. And as I got close to him, he snapped at me. He'd wag his tail and growl and snap. And I asked the farmer what's wrong with that dog. And the farmer said his spirit's broken. And that was my problem. My spirit was broken. And I didn't know that. Didn't know. I was physically near dead. I was. And I had no emotions. And I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was reborn. And those are the facts of it. And I have a spiritual disease. A disease that erodes my very essence. And isolates me in the presence of thousands of people. And it increases the dualism, the separation between me and the rest of the world. And you can look at me and say, "Why, his spirit's broken." And that's the way I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. In 1970, after having drank on a daily basis since I was 14 years old, and having taken pills on a daily basis since I was 33 years old, and that spans about 31 years. Yeah. I was practicing pathology in Auburn, Oklahoma. It is true they asked me to leave Melbourne. It is true I didn't pay any attention to them, and then they insisted that I leave Melbourne. That's all right. I got used to being asked to leave places. And because this happened so often, I decided I'd better get in a part of medicine that is not patient-oriented, so I took a residency in pathology. A pathologist is somebody that washes his hands before he goes to the bathroom. But see, you don't see any patients there. There's no live people that you have to take care of. I didn't think of course in mine, but a couple of them fell off tables trying to get away, but that's all right. So I became a pathologist. And the only place I could find to practice pathology, because my peculiarities were well known, was in Ardmore, Oklahoma. Now, I can assure you I would have never even stopped in Ardmore if I hadn't been an alcoholic. And they've assured me since that they shouldn't have had me in Ardmore, even though they couldn't find anybody else. But I was there because I'm an alcoholic, and they accepted me because they couldn't find another pathologist. In 1970, I was trying to practice pathology in Ardmore. And there was an OBGYN doctor, and this always really disgusted me some. He had a drinking problem. And he and I were out one night drinking. And he said, "How many kids do you have?" And I said, "One." He said, "Why don't you adopt a child?" I said, "I'd love to." Well, we were both drunk. Nobody was going to remember that. And on November the 5th, 1970, at about 2:30 in the morning, he called from the hospital and said, "You just adopted a little baby boy. Come get him." And I sent my mother, who was living with us at that time, over to get him because for some reason I was not appropriate then to visit the hospital. And she brought this little bundle back home. It was about an hour and a half or 2 hours old. And they'd washed it off and gessed it up and polished it. We looked at him and he said, "My gosh, he's so shiny, just like one of your bullets. He used to make bullets to skeet shoot, and I polish them." So that young fellow's name is Bullet. Bullet. And his name's Bullet because I'm an alcoholic. And my alcoholism drove me to the place he was born. And aren't I lucky? Aren't I lucky? Well, the Ardmore adventure was to last another year. As I kept on drinking. September 1971, my wife at that time was seeing a psychiatrist because she had a drinking problem. And one time he wanted me to come along with her so he could see her drinking problem, and I went up there. He was no shock to me. He was my 23rd psychiatrist. I've been seeing psychiatrists for years. And they're funny little creatures. And they're inquisitive, and they ask embarrassing questions. And I made up suitable lies for them. I don't talk about psychiatry much anymore, because I used to, but I don't anymore. Because I've got some friends that are psychiatrists, and they're very fine people. All of them are very fine people. They're cut out of a very fine pattern. They just sewed up wrong. Yeah. Got one that visits me up in Moultrie, you know. He comes by to see me every now and then and drives up in his Jaguar and gets out and communes with the flowers and watches the rocks grow. And if it's raining, I send somebody out to get him. But I had a bunch of them. I sure did. So I was seeing this psychiatrist who belonged to my wife. I won't claim him. And something funny happened in his office in that September of 1971, something I wasn't to understand until later. It was there in his office that I took the first step on the road to recovery from alcoholism, and I didn't know it. He said, "What's wrong?" And I said, "I'm an alcoholic, and my life's in shambles." And you see, I didn't know what that meant. And he didn't prod me into saying it. And I wasn't impacted by saying that. So we talked for a while. And I asked him what I could do. And he said, "Well, you ought to go to AA, but your insurance is pretty good, so why don't you come to my transactional analysis course?" So I did. I never done that before. And transactional analysis works. It worked well in me. As long as I went. And his little groups were on Tuesday, and I attended faithfully for a week, and I felt good. And I went back to Ardmore, and I said to this person I was living with, "Now we know the answer. You just got to watch how much you drink." And I went out to watch how much I drank, and I got me a new Buick. And my banker signed a note on it. And I got me a new fifth. And a new gun. And I got in my Buick with my fifth and my gun. I drove out in the country and I was shooting my gun and singing cowboy songs. And I turned that damn Buick over. And my life was unmanageable and my banker's life was unmanageable. And they took me to the hospital that I practiced medicine in. And they looked at me and they said, "You've got to do something about your drinking." What they really said is, "You got to leave, and you may as well do something about your drinking." I didn't hear all of that. So I did. I left, and I went down to a treatment center in Dallas, Texas. This is 1971, and this treatment center was run by two very fine men in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they did a good job. They just didn't do one thing that I've since come to believe is necessary for a person like me who has my kind of alcoholism. Because it wasn't until the 27th day that they got out the big book and we talked about these 12 steps. And we had 3 4-hour sessions on the 12 steps, and I thought they were most interesting. You see, I know it's an alcoholic. I just didn't know what it meant. They did a good job. I stayed sober 15 minutes. My wife was late to pick me up, and across the street was a whiskey store, and I went over to buy me just one fifth to celebrate my discharge. And I was drunk when she came after me. And I went home to Ardmore. And I went back to work. And that's when they told me, no, you misunderstood. We told you to leave. And that you may as well do something about your drinking. So they ran me out of Ardmore. Amen. And all I knew was that I was an alcoholic. My wife told me to leave. That was awful. Well, it really wasn't too bad. You see, I was raised in Oklahoma City, and I was just 125 miles from Oklahoma City, and I'm an only child. And what does a 44-year-old only child do when his wife kicks him out? He goes home to mama. And I did. And I drove my new Buick as best I could up to mama's house, and I went to the went in, she said, "What are you doing here?" And I told her. And she's that caricature of a good Christian woman. And she looked at me and smiled and said, "Oh, I'm so glad you get away from that bitch and you'll be okay." And I agreed. About a week, she called that lady and said, "Come get him. I can't do anything with him." So that lady came to Oklahoma City to do something with me. And she had been going to Al-Anon and she had her black belt and... They took me to the little house on North Broadway Street in Oklahoma City where it cost $3.75 a week. And they divided that up and paid 1 week's rent. And she detached with hate. And I woke up after a while and I went upstairs and I looked around and there were all these skinny, shivering, shaky, stinking drunks. And I said to the guy that ran it, who was one of them, incidentally, you don't know that I am a doctor of medicine. And I explained to him the impropriety of me being there. And he just kind of laughed, and I called my mama and I said, guess what she did to me? And mama said, I'll come get you. I'll take care of you, son. She came and got me. About a week later, she called this lady back and said, come get him. I can't do anything with him. So she came after me and took me back to the little club on North Broadway Street in Oklahoma City. And she detached with hate. And I got upstairs eventually and looked around. There were these same creatures. Gosh, I was incensed. But this time I went on upstairs, you know, and I looked around and went to one of the rooms. There was one of these little bitty things shaving, and he was shaving and shaking and not cutting himself. I thought it was marvelous. And there on his bedside table was some aqua velva. And he patted some on his face. And I said, is that yours? And he said, yeah. And he said, I said, can I borrow some? He said, sure. So I drank it. They kind of panic, don't you know? And while it was gone, I rummaged around and I found me some Vitalis, and that was my drug of choice at that time. And a little Micrin. Even found some Listerine, but I never really liked Listerine. And they came after me and they threw me out of the mission house from Skid Row in Oklahoma City. And they told me I was a bad influence on these men that were trying to straighten up their lives. And I went home to Mama. And she put me in a detox center. And I got out. And I got drunk and they put me back. And I broke in the drug room this time and nobody knew it. And I stayed high on pills all the time I was there. Then they called some people that I'd known in Alcoholics Anonymous. And for some strange reason, because I didn't care what happened to me, they took me to a rehab center in New Jersey. Well, they had a 28-day program for treating the poor, suffering, sick, alcoholic, and dope fiend. And I stayed there 5 months, and something happened. I didn't resist. I didn't care. It wasn't important. It was no longer important to drink. It was no longer important not to drink. Nothing mattered. And they were understanding and knowledgeable and wise. And they just let me sit, and I just sat. And I went to this place in June 1972 knowing one thing, that I was an alcoholic. And not knowing what that meant. And there I was. Nothing going on, attending lectures, attending tapes, attending with no meaning. And something happened in August that was, at least to this day, to change my life. I'm sure it changed my life no matter what happens from this date on. They had one of the little lectures when they talked about the Jelinek chart, you see, and the Jelinek chart, the picture of a man, little man, going through the various and sundry stages of alcoholism. And I've seen it several times. And you see, in the lectures, I sat alone. There's a little table they let me sit at. Nobody wanted to sit next to me. I went up there with two jumpsuits, and I wasn't very good about laundry. And I stunk. But I was sitting alone in this room and they brought that chart in. And I thought, oh my God, if they go over this again, I'll just die. I lit a cigarette, started drinking a cup of coffee, and I looked up and saw this chart. And something happened, and this is the way it is. This is the way it was. And if it's not this way, I'm deceiving myself. All of a sudden, it was as if I was alone in this room. There was something like 65 or 70 of us. But suddenly it was just me and that chart. And that's all I could see. And I looked at it and I said, my God, you've got a disease. And I could see the progressive nature of alcoholism. And as I was aware of this, I could hear, I could actually hear the title of the second chapter of the Big Book over and over and over. There is a solution, there is a solution, there is a solution. It rumbled in my mind. There is a solution, and you have a disease. And it was almost as if I could see, imposed upon that chart, that part of the big book that Jack just got through reading. The chapter agnostic and the description of the alcoholic and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. I could see that. One, that we are alcoholics and cannot manage our lives, and that no human power could relieve our alcoholism. And that God could and would if he was sought. I was aware of the disease. I could see this in my mind's eye. And I heard the title of the second chapter. And I got up and left. And ran down to my room and got out my big book. Because I wanted to see what it said next. And the very next line was, being convinced you are step three. And it was that moment, in that room, in that place, that I took the second step. I knew I had a disease, and I knew there was a solution that I'd never tried before. And I sure tried everything else. My head. If Father Pete wasn't here, I'd tell you about something. I'll tell you anyhow. I tried psychiatrists. I tried pills. I tried medicine, and I even tried religions. I'd been saved so many times, I had calluses. I went from baptism to Methodism. I even decided to be a Catholic. Didn't know how to do that. I talked to a friend of mine in AA and asked him where to start. I said, hell, go take confession. You may as well. That'll get you started in the fourth step. Well, what do you do? He said, well, you go in that little room and you say, forgive me, Father, for I've sinned. And he took another drink of beer. And so I went down to my little room and I sat down the little door and I said, well, forgive me, Father, for I've sinned. And he said, what'd you do? And I didn't know. I said, well, I stole some stuff. He said, that's okay. I said, I told some lies. He said, that's okay. What else? I said, well, I've committed adultery. And I could hear his eyes light up, you know. Who with? He got curious. And that really stumped me. I said, well, I can't tell you. This is my confession. Wouldn't be fair for me to tell on these people. He said, well, any of the women in my congregation? I said, sure. Well, who were they? I can't tell you, Father. Well, I got to pray for them, huh? He said, what was Miss Kelly? And I said, no. He said, what was Miss O'Leary? And I said, no. He said, was it Mrs. Jones's daughter, that cute one? And I said, no, sir. So he said something about 10 Hail Marys, 100 Our Fathers. I don't know what that meant. And I left and saw my friend outside. I said, well, how'd it go? I said, it went okay. So what did he say? He said something about 10 Hail Marys, 100 Our Fathers. He said, why are you grinning? I said, I got three good leads. Nothing I did seemed to help. Nothing. It just didn't work. Alcoholism is a strange disease. I remember one time I had a patient up in Highlands, North Carolina, where I used to doctor. And they were the mountain folks, you know, and they're kind of peculiar. Had one of these mountain men come by one day, and he sat down and said, I want you to pull my tooth. And I looked in his mouth, didn't have anything. He had one tooth. And I said, well, John, his name is John Jenkins. I said, John, I can't pull that tooth. I'm not a dentist. He said, your doctor said you have to pull the tooth. So I can't put it to sleep, so it don't make any difference. I don't feel pain. A couple of things have happened in my life that makes it impossible for me to feel pain. I said, okay. And I took me a little shot of rubby-dub. And I got out my pocket knife, and I busted off my britches, and I cut the gum around that tooth so I can get to it. And I got me a pair of pliers and I yanked on that tooth and I broke it off and I pried the roots out with a little old instrument. And John kind of squished the blood around his mouth and he spit it out and said, that all done? I said, that's all. He said, okay. I said, hey, don't that hurt? And he said, no. So, well, John, tell me about these experiences that you've had that makes you immune to pain. And John got kind of pale. He said, hey, think about them, Doc. Well, think about them and tell me about them. So we sat down, and he says, well, this is long about 10 years ago. We was out hunting, a bunch of us, hunting bear. And we hunted all day long and had no luck. He said, about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I come up against an old log. And I set my gun up against a tree, and I kind of hunkered on down over that log to relieve myself. He said, but unbeknownst to me, there was a bear trap chained to that log. And I must have wiggled a little too much as that bear trap went off and grabbed me. I said, Jesus Christ. And he got quiet, and I could see his pulse pounding in his ear. I said, John, I must have hurt. He said, it was awful. I said, well, when was the next time you had pain like that? He said, when I got to the end of that chain. And that's the way alcoholism is. Something's got us. We know where, but we don't know what. And it's insufferable. Nothing can hurt that bad, but we know that the very next step we're going to get to the end of that chain. And we know that no matter how bad it is, it's going to get worse. And that's the way I was with alcoholism. And that's the way I was when I was struggling to find some way out. Way out of my suffering. It didn't work. But I was setting up in Alena Lodge in October 1972, knowing there was a solution that might work. Might work. It could work. The Bill has said that we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves would restore us to sanity. I would have died because I couldn't believe that. But I could believe it could, and I believed it could. And I went to work. And I read the big book. And I read it a new way. I read it to see what it said instead of trying to figure out what the hell it meant. And on page 63 of the big book, I came across the most important words I've ever read. The most important paragraph in literature, as far as I'm concerned. Because on page 63 of the big book, it says we think seriously before making this decision. And I did. But then it says, we found it desirable to take this important step with another person. To take this with another person. Well, if these guys, these, thought it was desirable, for me it was absolutely necessary. So I found a priest who was also a patient there and asked him if he would do this with me. And it came to pass in my life that it was on August the 8th, 1972, at 3:30 in the afternoon, underneath a pine tree in the Pocono Mountain, in an alcohol treatment center outside Blairstown, New Jersey, with a priest named Thomas J. Cochran, that I turned my will and my life over to the care of a God that I hoped was. I hoped. And I remember that moment, and it was not dramatic. It was not. Nothing happened. The clouds didn't open with an announcement of, this is my son in whom I'm well pleased. Nothing happened. I was afraid when I went there. I was afraid when I left this pine tree, this priest, and this hillside. But I went down to my room and I got out my big book, and opposite that paragraph on page 63, I wrote, August the 8th, 1972, with TJC. I was to learn many years later that August the 8th was Emancipation Day. That's the day that Lincoln signed the Emancipation Proclamation. And isn't that interesting? And I woke up on August the 9th, 1972, in this condition, that knot that was such an integral part of my gut was gone. I actually felt for it, and it wasn't there. That feeling of impending doom was no longer present. I was scared to death still, but I didn't feel that sense of impending disaster. The knot was gone, and it's never returned. And I knew it was going to be okay. I spent the next several years trying to figure out what the hell it was. But it's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. And I believe with all my heart and soul that on that day, God allowed me to make a permanent, irrevocable covenant with him, that no matter what I do, he will always offer me a way out as he takes care of my will and my life. I begin to believe the third step is like the parable about the wayfarer walking through the hills, and he comes across a shepherd minding his flock. The shepherd's got a little lamb in his arms. And he's feeding him. And the wayfarer said, oh, is the little fellow sick? And the shepherd said, no, he's a self-willed creature. He runs through the woods. He won't pay attention to the dogs and the hounds. And I'm afraid he's going to get hurt because he's out where the wolves are. And the wayfarer said, did he hurt himself? And the shepherd said, no, I broke his leg. I broke his leg. And I've experienced in my life, since August 8, 1972, having my leg broken as I willfully refused to do what I knew to do. And that, I believe, is the care of God on occasion. It is not necessarily, in every case, to extract us from a troubled situation. It's to make us aware of what we can do and make us aware of what we have been doing as letters. And it's very painful, but healing. I turned the page, and on top of page 64, you see, I've been listening to these folks in AA, and I decided to wait a while till my brain cleared up and write my inventory in detail and probably publish it as a great American drama and take the fifth step of the entire literary world. They might want to even devote an edition of Reader's Digest to my glorious past. And I was going to do that. And a lot of people advised me to wait a while. Wait till you're clear up, see, and saint. And you'll know when you need to. Yeah. Just after they sober you up the next time, you probably need to do that. But the big book, you know, and it really is the only text written on the treatment of alcoholism and drug addiction. And it says on page 64, this decision, referring to the third step, the vital and crucial one, but of little lasting value, unless at once followed by trying to identify what's been blocking us from recovery. I had no choice. I had to write an inventory at once. That meant August 1972, when I was confused. And I got me a Hazelman guide, and an Al-Anon guide, and a Big Book guide, and this, and the Ten Commandments. And I got all these little guides, and I just scribble away. And I finally decided to read the Big Book and see what he said, and it said to make a list of people, places, and things we resented. People, institutions, and principles we resent, and I did it. And why you resent them, and I did it. And what it affected, and I tried to do it. Then I made a list of fears, and I quit. Then I've done. Now, they wouldn't let us take the fifth step up in that place. So I didn't know what to do. And for lack of anything better to do that night, I continued to take personal inventory. I just started doing it every night. And that's been the story of my life. On the 2nd of October, 1972, they walked up to me and said, we're going to send you home today. We've done all we can do for you. We fear for your sobriety. And little big tears fell down their little faces. And I was kind of incensed, you know. This lady was not a doctor. She had convinced me I have a disease. And they told me what the treatment for the disease was, and I know how to treat diseases. So I was really, really upset about that, but I didn't say anything. She told me how worried she was about me, and she told me I should go to a meeting that night and a meeting every night. And I was in agreement to do that. So I got on the plane to go back to Oklahoma City, and I let the plane land in Oklahoma City at 9:10. And I got off the plane ready to go to a meeting because I knew that's what I had to do. But the meetings were over. I could not do what I knew I had to do. I could not do what I knew how to do. And I know exactly what the Big Book means when it says self-knowledge avails us nothing. Nothing. I knew I was powerless. And I knew what it meant to be powerless. And it was awful and it was frightening. And I was full of insecurity, and I did this when I went back to my mama's house. I wasn't allowed in Ardmore yet. And we took all of her perfume that she had brought back in the house and all of her mouthwash and took it out and put it in the trunk of her car because I was bad about drinking that stuff. She took all the money I had, $5, and she hid it. And we called my sponsor. And he would hang up, and I'd call him back, and he'd tell me to call his sponsor. It was awful. You see, I knew I was going to drink that night, but I didn't. I didn't. I don't care what we know. I don't care how smart we are or think we are. I don't care what our background means. Self-knowledge avails us nothing. We need to find a source of power that can protect us from our disease. At those moments of temptation and throughout life. You see, nothing causes us to drink. If you go, wonder why do you drink? Why? Nothing makes us drink. Our brain demands a drink. We are supposed to drink with our disease. That's an inside job. The question we've got to ask ourselves is, what can I do so I won't drink? What didn't I do so I didn't have to drink? Because if we don't do certain things, we're going to drink. No matter what happens in the world around us, doesn't make any difference. It's going to get to us. It's going to get to us. Now, I went from October 1972, and my life unfolded. And my wife welcomed me home finally. She came back to me in July 1973. And she tried to put a family back together, and I didn't, because my life was full. My cup was running over. I was working every day. I was going to AA, and I wasn't thinking about drinking or drugging. We rocked along. And 1975, we began treating the alcoholic and drug addict in our own home to make the home something. About 4 years later, we separated because we'd lost the battle. The fight was over. The only thing that had been evident in our house for many, many years was our struggle against alcoholism. And that was done. There was nothing left. And then 1981, 1982, I began devoting all of my medical energies to alcoholism. And I got involved in full-time treatment. And my cup was full. Yeah. You people got to understand about people like me that are full-time in alcoholism. You see, a lot of things we don't have to do that you got to do. We don't have to go to meetings. Me. Because we're with the alcoholic all day long. And we're at meetings all day long. We don't have to go to meetings. We're too tired. That sounds good. I believe it. So about 1978, I backed off meetings and finally quit going to meetings and had to move from the part of Pensacola I was living in to another part and left my home group, but my cup was full and I was doing well. 1983, some people asked me to come to Kentucky to put together a treatment. I did. And then in some strange reason, 1984, they asked me to leave. They figured I'd done my job and I didn't know that was coming, and I left. And my wife got terrorized, and my new wife got terrorized. She got panicky. She got sick. And I started traveling looking for new work, and it was a mess. Finally decided in March 1984 or 5 to just start practicing general medicine again, opened me an office up in Kentucky. And one night I was kind of medical society meeting. It was a kind of medical society meeting. They served wine. I turned my glass upside down. They'd been doing that for years. And some dodo, you know, I turned my glass upside down, he turned it back upside up. Filled it full of wine, I drank it. And I was terrorized. I was scared to death because I knew exactly what was going to happen. I knew what it meant when it talks about there are times when you have no mental defense against the first drink, and I didn't even try. And I didn't want it, and I didn't know I was in trouble. But I knew I was powerless. And for about 2 weeks, I controlled this urge. Then I drank again. I went down to see a friend of mine in Little Rock, and we put together a program that I knew I couldn't follow. And I went back and tried to get back in AA, and I couldn't do it. And I struggled and controlled my drinking. But I didn't control my collapse. That was the most horrible experience of my life, because I remember this. I remember this state where I had forgotten, I didn't know about the state back in 1972, but I was alone. I was alone among people that needed and wanted and loved me. And I couldn't respond, and I abandoned them. I abandoned my wife, and I abandoned AA, and I abandoned God, and I abandoned me. And I knew it was hopeless, and I knew it was helpless, and I knew I was doomed, and I was floating through space, totally alone, untouchable, unreachable, horrible. And I remember it. So in June, I called a friend of mine in New York in Washington, D.C., and asked him if there was any hope. And he said, close that medical office and come up here. And I did. And they put me in a treatment center. Everybody knew what the problem was. They would just leave me alone and let me work on the step process. I knew I was an alcoholic. There was no doubt about that. I knew I could get well. There was no doubt about that. So I called a preacher to come out and take the third step with me. And before this appointment time arrived, I realized I couldn't do that. I couldn't take the third step. I had taken it. It was not retakeable. It was a done thing. It was over, completed, and permanent. And I was confused till I realized that God was still taking care of me. But the pain of what had happened was God's care. And it was insufferable. So the third step, the ritual was not there for me. But I did write an inventory of fear and anger since 1972. And brought that up to date. And it was horrible, because I had fears I didn't know about. And angers I wasn't aware of. And self-centeredness that was totally obsessing. Horrible. I took a fifth step. And on this four-step inventory, I became aware of one thing that I'd never become aware of yet before. I was afraid of God. And the awareness of that fear almost drove me to suicide. Because I love God so. And I knew what he had done for me these 13, 14 years. And I was scared, and I didn't know it. A gut-eating, eroding fear of the least fearful of all objects, or the most awesome, but the least fearful. And from that point on, my recovery is driven by freedom from the fear of God. And I have never, never, never been aware of the certainty that it's going to be all right as I am now. I'm no longer afraid, and that's awesome. And what happened in those years? Got out of Alena, hadn't taken the fifth step. My sponsor got tired of talking to me and arranged me to take a fifth step to the Episcopalian priest. And I did in November 1972. I did something peculiar. I've been reading the big book to see what it says, and it says that you admit to God yourself and another human being, exact nature of wrongs. I still live with Mama, and I went back to my little room, Mama's house, and I got this thing out. And I read it to God, this list of fears and angers. I admitted it to God, then I took a nervous pee, and I admitted it to myself, And I got in my car and went down to Shawnee, Oklahoma, and admitted it to another person. The exact nature of my wrong. This is a spiritual inventory, a moral inventory. What is blocking me from people? What is limiting me? Morality has to do with my relationship with people, self, and God. And that's what it's all about, fear and anger. I know I'm supposed to get alone for an hour, you know, and go over the first five propositions so I could look at steps 6 and 7, but I was so humbled by this experience with this step that I had to get a meeting to brag about what I'd done. So I bounced to a meeting to brag about the fifth step and didn't take the 6 and 7. That became the most difficult thing I've done in Alcoholics Anonymous, the steps 6 and 7. I tried so hard. I made a list of defects: arrogance, anger, lust. That was more hope than a defect. Had this list, and I'd get down on my knees and I'd say, "God, take them away," and get up mad as hell because they were still there. And I'd go to a meeting and tell me, "That's okay, son, it's going to take a while." I even thought about writing my inventory again so I could take the fifth step again, so I could spend an hour alone so my inventory wouldn't write. Then in April 1973, for no other reason except idleness, I decided to see what the difference between a shortcoming and a defect was. Now, I don't lecture when I talk, except for this. I believe that every alcoholic, every member of Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon, should get out their dictionary, their Webster's dictionary, and look up the word defect. And I think they should be willing to give up their old ideas, because the result is nil until we let go absolutely. You see, I had a list of defects: anger, arrogance. You won't believe that, but that's the way people do sometimes in clever men. All these things, and they wouldn't go away. And I looked up in the word shortcoming in the dictionary, see how different from a defect. What's the difference? Dictionary said a shortcoming is a defect. And so I looked up the word defect. You know what it said a defect is in the dictionary? And every dictionary I've seen since then, I always look that word up, says that a defect is something that is lacking, that is necessary for completeness. It says a defect is a deficiency. And I looked at my defects, and I had resentment down there. And I was not deficient in resentments. Nor did I lack resentments. Nor did I lack arrogance, hate, bitterness. These were not defects. It's what I had lost in my spiritual collapse that left me vulnerable to these negative traits. And I had to look at myself to see not what's there, but what's missing. And I got out of my inventory and I went back over it and I studied and thought. And I could see great voids in me. The lack of the ability to forgive. I couldn't forgive. And I kept trying to do something I couldn't do. I could not love, and I kept trying to love, but I couldn't. Many things that I could no longer do. They were my defects of character. These were my shortcomings. And I finally got down on my knees and I said, "Did God take away all these deficiencies, all these voids in my life, those I know about and those I don't, and let me be whole again?" And I believe that happened. I believe, though I didn't feel any better, I left that session. I got up on my knees and once again I was whole. Once again I was capable. And I was entering a spiritual kindergarten. Now, I didn't forgive anyone at that moment, and I didn't stop hating. But then I knew I could if I'd work at it. And my life since then has been a constant process of looking at what I am so I can see what's missing. And ask God to make me less deficient and these things that are missing. And the 10th step has become a viable, effective part of my life. And it's functional. And it's not morbid, it's not painful. Because it's a great adventure out there to see where we can go from here. It's a sadness to see where our alcoholism and drug addiction has driven us to a point where we're void in these traits. But isn't it marvelous that we can change? And I went on in 1973, and I went back to work. And I told you that we began treating alcoholics in our home. And one of the first people we brought in committed suicide in our bedroom. He was not a rip-roaring success. Bad things happened and good things happened. In 1975, I was speaking at the Tri-State Convention in Shreveport. You know, I had a daughter that was 15 when I got sober. In 75, she was 19, and she was going to college in St. Augustine. My wife called me when I was in Shreveport and said, "You must come home. Robin is sick." And I left, and we went and drove down to St. Augustine. And this little girl was paralyzed. She had a disease that occurs after the flu in young women and causes them to get progressively more paralyzed. And then as time passes, it goes away. She was paralyzed up to her neck. She could barely breathe. I flew back to Pensacola to arrange to have my laboratory taken care of, and then I came. And while I was gone that one day, she had to have a tube put in her windpipe, and I wasn't there again. And I got back, and she was on a respirator. And I didn't understand. I went to the family room, and I sat there, and I came to understand that God take care of Robin. Just keep our hands out of it and just support her. So we did. We sat around and watched her. She couldn't blink her eyes. She couldn't communicate, but she could hear us. And we talked, and some of the little EMTs came in, and they all fell in love with her. She was a beautiful young lady. On the 14th, function started to come back. She could bat her eyes. We knew she was getting well. So I flew back to Pensacola to arrange to get an air ambulance to come get her so we could nurture at home. And I got a phone call at about 1:30 in the morning on November the 16th from my wife. She said, "Robin has just died. Just died." This tube had gone through her windpipe into a great vessel, and she had bled to death. And the last thing I'd said to her, "Honey, I'll be back tomorrow. And don't you worry. Wherever this disease takes you, I will go." She batted her eye. And her mother was alone again. And I was alone. I made one phone call at 1:30 in the morning to a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and within 20 minutes, my house was full of strength. And you see, I had no strength. Spiritual strength is being needed and wanted and loved. And those traits were the property of the friends around me, not my own. They needed me and they wanted me and they loved me, and my spiritual strength came from that. And I didn't have to fight the spiritual battle. And they came there and they were my strength. And a couple of them took me back to St. Petersburg to get my daughter. And they brought Robin back to Pensacola. And this was the way it was those days. The next morning I went down alone to see her, to be alone with her. And I'd always thought before then that the pain of death belonged to the people that were suffering and not the world around us. But I walked into that funeral parlor with all those beautiful flowers. And this lovely, lovely woman lying in this narrow house, quite alone. And I cried, and I felt, and I suffered. And I walked up to her, and I touched her, and she was cold. And I can remember thinking, how can this happen to me? How can this happen to me? And all of a sudden, something made me aware, told me, or whatever, however this occurs, but you've been sober 4.5 years. You've been sober 4.5 years. Aren't you lucky? And I was astounded. I was sober 4.5 years. And I was fortunate. And I was filled with a sense of gratitude, unfettered and unlimited, and joy for my sobriety, because it could have been so horrible. And wasn't I lucky? And I know since then what it means when it says God does for us what we cannot do for ourselves. And I know the pain that occurs at times like this when you remove yourself, or yourself is removed from the problem and the grief is all for somebody else. The depths of sadness, despair, and hurt that occurs if you're free of self. It's almost unmanageable, but it's a glorious experience. And the time of my greatest tragedy, and I'll never, never, never experience anything like that again. I had my moments and days and weeks of greatest gratitude. Jesus, how lucky we are. What might have been if God had not interfered directly into my life through alcoholics anonymous? What trouble I'd be in. What a mess that would have been. What a mess. The preacher came from Oklahoma to share this with us. I went out and picked him up and brought him into the house. He walked into the foyer and there was nobody else around. And he looked at me and said, "Where did this come from? I've been searching for this all of my life." I took him back into the Florida room and showed him where it came from. The people of Alcoholics Anonymous were there and being themselves and needing and wanting and loving us. And he understood. And I went to the graveside that afternoon. We didn't have a funeral service. We had a graveside service. And we all gathered and the family sat down. And these things happened. And we sat down in front of the casket. And as the preacher started preaching, I could hear our friends, and there were a multitude of them, whispering and drawing closer, and their clothes rustled. And I didn't understand. And the preacher closed his little book. You see? And our friends came up to us and said, "Did you see it? Did you see it? Did you see it?" I said, "I see what?" "Well, that beautiful butterfly that came to the casket and visited rows after rows after rows, and then flew away when the preacher finished." I've got many notes about that from people, and I didn't see it. But you know, the butterfly is not the miracle. The miracle is I understood, and I accepted, and I was comforted by this statement. There is no miracle to the fact that I was reborn, and that you've been reborn. The miracle is that we're not afraid to live. We're not afraid to see, and we're not afraid to hear, and no longer afraid to experience. But the greatest miracle of my life is I'm not afraid of God. I did stop going to meetings. God broke my leg. I suffered miserably. And I'm fully aware of the suffering I experienced. You know, I wasn't embarrassed, or I wasn't ashamed, because I know I have a disease. And I learned more about the disease. It's a hell of a way to learn. But it's part of my story. If people were to ask me, for instance, what do you get the most pleasure out of in life today? Well, I get the most pleasure out of moments like this, you see. Well, I'm out there, up here, or just in the middle of things and surrounded by people that have known me since I took my first drink. And I say, folks I know that I haven't seen for a while. I see people that I see occasionally in strange places. I ran into Bob and Ruth Funk. He and I were talking about this anonymity thing. It's very important that we don't let people use our full name at the level of press, radio, or television, or movies. But sometimes they do, you know. If they do, we want them to spell it right, for Christ's sake. But I go places and see people, and every person I see, though it might be the first time, I recognize as my oldest friend. And that's the joy of my life. Somebody said, Doc, what's the most important thing you've ever learned about medicine? I could tell them, without any doubt, that the most important medical fact that I know is that alcoholism and depraved dope fiendism are diseases. Diseases that take the will out of the use of drugs for pleasure. They are diseases. And not only that, but there is a solution. And I think this is the most important medical fact for America today. We have a disease and there is a solution. A solution. If somebody asked me what the most important thing I ever did, and that, my trouble with that question is trying to find something, anything important I've done. Without question, the most important thing I ever did, and it's far more important than anything I'll ever do again, I know this, was when I met with TJC on August 8, 1972, and turned my will and my life over to the care of God as I understood Him. Nothing will ever equal that. As a result of that, and as a result of not trying to figure things out, I've come to a point in life, and I came to this point very quickly, where there is a certainty that God is, not a belief, but an assurance. And if this can come to a person who is confused as I am, we needn't worry about anybody else. And we need to struggle with them about what they understand and what they believe. Just let them flop around and they'll come to know. Somebody said, what's the most important thing you ever wrote? It certainly was a four-step spiritual or moral inventory dealing with my fears and angers, my need to fight and flee. Most important thing I ever read was that self-same inventory when I read it to that Episcopalian down in Shawnee, Oklahoma. The most important thing I do is to continue to take personal inventory on a daily basis and to start the day off quietly, as I look at Seth 10 and 11. That's right. And if somebody said, what's the most important thing that's ever happened to you? Oh, please don't doubt this. The most important thing that's happened to me is that I have had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps. We all have had. If you are in a position where you're doing steps 10 and 11 on a daily basis, and you don't understand that you've had a spiritual awakening, it's just because you aren't aware. Stop and look at it and remember and be aware of this fact as you practice these principles in all your affairs. My son Bullet, when he's about six, had a favorite saying, ain't you glad, ain't you glad, ain't you glad, everything that happened, ain't you glad. Mama saw that man again, ain't you glad? She also found that key, ain't you glad? The tax man's here, ain't you glad? The cash plate, ain't you glad? And he came running out of the house one day when I got home from work, and he ran up to me, and I grabbed him and lifted him up and shook him, and I said, hey, fella, what's your name? And he looked at me, and he backed up a little bit, and he said, my name is Bullet Morton, ain't you glad? Ain't you glad? My God, I tried that day. You know, lift it up. Oh, I'm so glad his name's Willard Morris. I'm so glad I'm an alcoholic. Because that's why his name is Bullet Morton. If I had it to do over, I wouldn't change one drink, one pain, one agony, one suffering. Because it might have been different. And I might not have been in Ardmore. And I wouldn't change having been an alcoholic and an addict for nothing. Or it might have been better and I might have been richer. But I might have been dead. And I know one thing for sure, I wouldn't be in Orlando today. And I can't think of anything I'd swap this for. And his name wouldn't be Bullet Morton. God, I'm lucky. Everything that alcoholism can do to people is done to me. Everything, I think. I've had 22 DUIs. I've spent 28 months in crazy houses. I've had shock treatment. I've had 4 wives, and I'm so lucky. Well, yeah, I was married for 20 years of my drinking, and I decided that we had to fall in love, and may as well fall in love with somebody else. So I left the house, and about a month and a half after I moved out, I was a consultant at a little treatment center in Pensacola, and I went by to give my weekly or bi-weekly lecture, and there was the prettiest, sweetest, most non-alcoholic creature you ever saw. That woman couldn't be an alcoholic. She's too pretty. And so I got her name, and I had some people bird dog her for a while and watch her to make sure she was okay. And some of my friends, I wouldn't go to those meetings because you ain't supposed to. But after about 6 months, I decided she was fine. And she really wasn't an alcoholic. And she was delivering auto parts in a truck. And I figured she needed a new job, and I inquired if she'd ever done the secretarial work, and they said no, and I figured she ought to learn then. So I had a secretary for about 8 years, and I fired her. I got her a better job, and she was fussing about a raise, so I just found her a better job, and I hired this lady. And a couple years later, we were married. I met her after my wife and I were separated. It's been a beautiful relationship. It's been an awesome thing. And she's with me, and stand up and let them see you, sweetheart. Let me tell you something. She is an alcoholic. For a while, she was a dope fiend. But she's been sober a considerable time and got a beautiful program that helps me. These things are all important. They're a result of recovery. But the finest thing that I've ever received in my whole life, the most sterling, valuable gift that is an awesome thing, occurred back in 1972 when A made me sober and allowed me and gave to me the one thing that I prized at the time most dearly and still. You gave something to me to give my daughter a sober daddy. If it weren't for you, she would have died. And she would have died and never had a daddy that was sober. My God, you're wonderful. You gave it to me. You did. And she remembers it. And she lets me know how grateful she still is. She tells me. The most beautiful gift of all, a sober daddy. And I thank you for it. And I love you for it. And I want you to know that I'm glad I'm an alcoholic. And I'm glad you are. Because I would have been in one hell of a fix 4 years ago if you hadn't been. And you are my strength. And you are my spiritual strength. Because it is you that needs and wants and loves me. And you are my daughter's favorite people. and you're certainly mine. And if I had a prayer that I could wish for you, it would be that you could, and perhaps you do, feel the way I feel. When I see that young fellow today, and every time I see him, I ask him one question. I look at him and I say, "Bullet, what's my name?" And he says, "Well, you're Dr. Gene Morton, and you're an alcoholic, and ain't you glad?" And I am. When he says that, what does Jimmy Swaggart do besides look at women? He raptures. That's what he does. It's marvelous. It's there for the feeling. It's there for the being. It's there for all of us. God bless you as you bless me. Thanks for being here.